Hi, and welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. I'm Chris Lucian, and with me is my co-host, Austin Chadwick. And today, our guest is Colleen Kirtland, and she is an agilist in a lot of the communities that I frequent, and it's really cool running into her at all these conferences. And today, we're going to talk about organizational agility, quest for value, and our favorite mob programming. You know, it's just, Colleen, could you maybe introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do, and maybe we can get into the first topic after that.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Colleen Kirtland, and I'm a practitioner in the greater Agile community. I'd like to even say globally, because I do connect with a few people all around the planet, but mostly in Southern California. And I'm currently working at a wonderful company called Pacific Life. And I actually have been down to see Chris and Austin at their day jobs too. So it's been really fun.
This episode's a particular fun for me as well, because I've been able to have the pleasure of interacting with Colleen at several conferences. And then also she has done some visiting remote mob programming with us, which has always been a lot of fun, and learned a lot from her and her teammates. So to kind of jump into the first topic, we will come back to mob programming though, is organizational agility, agility beyond tech, business agility, complexity systems. So what have you been discovering lately in this realm?
Okay, so the story goes back a little further, right? I'm gonna set the context for this. So, you know, in being a part of a number of organizations and watching agility kind of grow naturally within different organizations, especially when we look at larger enterprises, different kinds of companies, different kinds of businesses, you know, one thing I've always noticed is that I feel like agility develops in a way where the tail wags the dog. What do I mean by that? What I mean by this is, interestingly enough, you know, I mean, since our beloved Agile Manifesto was born back in the early 2000s, the original capital A Agile was built for software development, right? I mean, that's what all the founders of capital A Agile did. And so the interesting thing about that is as the approaches, I mean, it's been close to 20 years now since that very first famous meeting of the practitioners who signed the manifesto. And when you really look at capital A Agile, if you were to look at it along the innovation curve, I would believe we are in the late majority of adoption for capital A Agile. And you know, it's always bothered me in some ways that the tail does wag the dog. And I'll tell you why, because the tail has been wagging the dog, we have, as an Agile practitioner community and industry, developed all kinds of training and learning paths that are very geared on initially Scrum and other things. And I love Scrum for where it can be used appropriately and other things. But if you think about it, the learning paths and all the things we've done have been guided toward technology, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. But when you look at, unless you're working for Google where technology is the business or something like that, a lot of us, and maybe yourselves included, actually work where technology is a huge enabler of business success, right? And in organizations like mine currently, that's also the case. Well, in these cases, you know, I think that agility really needs to be looked at in a larger context, because what ends up happening is if we go off as a software development team and just start doing things, whether it's Scrum or using Kanban, are we really operating in the context of how? You know, that's the key question. And in all honesty, with all these years and for all my love of Agile, I really truly believe that we've been operating in the context of how without starting with the why and then letting that sort of blossom into the what. And so this kind of backwardness of how Agile typically gets adopted is something that has been plaguing me for many, many years about how do we reverse that? Because really what happens if you look at it in kind of an organizational context, we're speaking our own language and we're talking to ourselves. I mean, that's really, in all honesty, what we're doing. And so, you know, I started to really explore this question because it's so important to follow the guidance of Simon Sinek, to start with why, right? And really get an understanding, because the key thing about it is, whether we're using Scrum or Kanban, we're delivering value. And there is no such thing as value without why. So everything must start there with the why. So I've been looking and kind of searching for ways and organizations anywhere in the world that are really thinking about framing up organizational agility. And so I've been on this long journey, and you know, I'm happy to say that I stumbled upon, in kind of a lucky way, this small organization, but very influential organization called the Business Agility Institute. It's actually based out of Australia and run by a wonderful person named Evan Laybourne. I think that could answer a question of who you might have on the next show, who has, with his colleague, Ahmed Sidki, has created a really good framework to look at an organization as a holistic system and all of its key interactions. And what I became so enamored with is I was invited as a guest speaker, and I spoke on systems thinking and other things, which we can get to. But the more important thing is, you know, when you go to a business agility conference, it is not technologists. It's a lot of HR. It's a lot of finance. And when you start to look at the key stumbling blocks to overall enterprise or organizational agility, oftentimes it's in our greater system policy, right? Like, for instance, I mean, even unintentionally, this is nothing against HR, but if we have a traditional organization that has very, very specialized job families, that system in and of itself will then create this impediment to cross-pollinating knowledge, because I'm the specialist of a certain narrow slice, right? So these are interesting structures, and it made me think a lot about kind of like really understanding any organization you're in terms of its initial structure and its initial condition, right? And so I think what I really like is the Business Agility Institute has put together a really nice sort of, I'll call it a framework, but it's more a way of thinking about holistically about the organization. And some of their talks are just so inspiring because they not only deal with a multitude of different industries, they have NGOs and government organizations participating as well. So the transformation feels very global, feels very broad and inclusive. And in addition, you know, some of the topics that are coming up that are, I feel, maybe would not yet be accepted in the language of some traditional corporate cultures is like, you know, talks that are entitled Leading with Love, you know, things like this. And then structurally, beyond these emotional topics, there's questions about how do you fund agile teams? I mean, it's really not that simple in many organizations to fund dedicated teams, because we're still working in a project mode or a kind of fund a tranche, approve a tranche, execute a tranche mode, right? So these are really great questions. And I feel like that community is starting to really address these and understand them in a more inclusive manner, right? So there's a lot less talk about practices and approaches, and more about different ways in which the whole enterprise engages, right? So I'm captivated and will continue to support the work they do because of this. And, you know, I mean, and my whole journey there was around systems thinking. And so last March, when the pandemic first broke, that's a whole other story. There was a conference that they had, their global conference, and I did talk about thinking in systems there, because that's kind of what they do too, right? So that's kind of the long and short of some of this organizational agility. And I think it's just so important. I'm so impassioned by this work, because I think most of us, or many of us, work for companies that aren't pure technology companies.
Do you have any advice for our listeners around, I guess, shifting the perspective, the conversation to why instead of what and how?
That's what I'm experimenting with right now as we speak. It's so funny that you would. Yes. I mean, and this is so interesting. Okay, so like, if you start with the premise that we can't be too abstract, Now I have some stuff later I definitely want to share because I'm just an abstract thinker. I love to synthesize knowledge from people that are smarter than myself, which are a multitude on this planet, right? But if we start with something practical, let's just take the role of a product owner. You know, I am almost at that point where I would go to the Scrum Alliance and beg and beseech them to change the name to value owner. That one generative term may deeply affect how we actually think about that role, right? And what's so interesting about this role is there, you can see YouTubes on it, and I don't know if it happened in your organization, but so many times that is a neglected role that is so hard to get people into that chair,
yeah.
Right? And it's so hard to lead, kind of inspire people to want to take that role. And I ask myself, what are the drivers behind that? Why isn't there more interest in this role? And it finally dawned on me when I was taking this really great class on product leadership. That's the second person I might recommend to follow up. It's a woman in Florida. Her name is Anjali Leon, and she does excellent work on product ownership. In fact, I would say I met her at the Business Agility Institute, but then I also took the class she offers. And since now, with COVID, I can take her class in Florida and not have to fly there. And she started to present something that really resonated with me. I mean, a number of different, she brought in a number of different thought works, but there was one picture that she presented. And if you have a website, I'll send you that picture. It's this wonderful pyramid of like how you look at value. And it's kind of like a take on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but it's a hierarchy of value. And it's the pinnacle of this pyramid is like those amazing things that better humanity. I mean, it's very, very lofty. It's like a lofty goal that you talk about. And then at the bottom of the pyramid, you know, is the functional aspects of delivering value. And this light bulb went off in my head to say, oh my gosh, the current product owner role as it's framed is entirely functional with very little driver for the greater lofty goal. And that's why we've been stuck in backlog management for years, right? So like these light bulbs started to go off in my head and I'm like, this is all a conversation about how we shift value. So going back to your original question, Chris, you know, I think that one way we can approach this and start to experiment on the shift to why is start to shift value through this product owner lens. So I'm hoping to get voice with the Scrum Alliance to say, let's change it to value owner one, because that'll elevate our mission. And then let's start to really, really explore the meaning of value, right? This is where, man, this is where we're going to have tons of fun. And when I look at, you know, the development of our whole Agile community is maybe around this space of exploring why and value, because that's where everything starts. And then, of course, later down when we've all funded it and we're in execution mode, we can do cool things like mobbing. We can even share with the product owner how to elevate value more. But right now, a lot of our teams are trained in methods and practices, which are very important. But we don't have that quest for value yet, because this is a conversation that is really hard to unpack when you're dealing with now a whole training complex around product ownership that is really around backlog management and prioritization. But when you think about prioritization, it's still prioritizing value. So it all goes back to this question of value. And then this led me to this other quest. And I'm going to continue this quest probably until my career ends. But I was trying to find ways in which we could challenge the socioeconomics of value, right? And I just said, there's got to be smart people who study this. I mean, you can always find somebody way smarter than yourself that can teach you so much. And I have been on this quest for years now looking for this. And I have stumbled upon some gems. I don't know if you could get them on the show, but there's a woman at Oxford and then another, at, I believe, the London School of Economics, who are shaking it up in terms of value. So let me give you a little bit of insight into the exciting things I want to explore and maybe fuse with value ownership. So I was really pitching this book to everybody at the Agile Open last week because it's life-changing for me. There's a woman named Kate Raworth, and she's a professor at Oxford, and she wrote this fantastic book called Donut Economics. And literally, I'm reading it, rereading it. I'm just totally into it because there's so much there. You can tell she has synthesized so much great work. And there's a couple key premises in this book that I think are really important. So she's really challenging traditional economics, which she studied in terms of the historic evolution of traditional economics. And what I never knew is that there was a point in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when economics was trying to seek legitimacy. And in doing so, the thought leaders really tried to fuse it with Newtonian physics. And so they tried to use a lot of linear math to describe the economy, right? And so she does this wonderful and brilliant history about how this happened, and she traces it back really quite well. And so in essence, what we've done with our whole economic system is we've based it on this kind of growth model. And one even might say an unlimited growth model. Well, the challenges with this unlimited growth model that have resulted and that we see manifested today is that there is a great disparity of wealth between the most rich and the most poor. And in addition, we are wreaking havoc on our environment because this growth engine has to keep on producing more and more, right? And so she introduces this wonderful picture that I hope from today forward is taught to every fifth grader in school when we first study economics. It's the donut. And the donut is the center of the whole is like what you'd consider abject poverty, a place we don't want to be. And then outside of the actual physical donut is the external pressure on the closed system that we call Earth's environment and limited resources that we need to not extract, but constantly rejuvenate. So the sweet spot for humanity is on that donut. And I like it because she says, okay, the sweet spot is on the donut. So this is the kind of thing that I'm really trying to lean into in terms of understanding the conversation on value. Because now we're elevating to human needs and social betterment. And I think that it is critical that our businesses shift that focus as well. And so this value quest is just getting me so jazzed, you know, these days about, and then how we bring it back to Agile. How do we get our product owners to be value owners and see that deep connection to the good they're doing? I mean, even in something as simple as what my company produces, an annuity, a lifetime stream of income. This might help us when we are no longer able to work and other things. You know, really, I think our companies do a good job marketing these things, and there's generally goodwill, right, around the things we do. But how do we, if we're producing things for society at large, what are we doing? I mean, in the case of your company, you know, I like the water conservation aspect because certainly in California, that's one a key topic, right? Okay. And so, yeah. So I'm just so jazzed about where the value conversation could lead because we've really been wagging it from the tail. Mm-hmm. And now we need to address the head here, which is the deep reasons why we even do things and why companies exist and what are they there to serve? You know, I know we can't live in the esoteric all the time, where sometimes where my mind lives, but even with that, if we inspire our teams to think beyond functional value, yeah. I think that's a reason to come to work every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you so much for sharing. And I have a couple follow-up questions. And it's partly inspired by talks from Woody or conversations I've had with Woody in regards to systems thinking and value and why. And the important things you're talking about is that so often people have a mindset of what do I do? You know, like you said, someone very focused on the what and the how, and they say, just tell me what to do or how do I do it? You know what I mean? And And the trouble is I feel like there's a couple options. One is you just like, you're asking the wrong questions, I can't help you, you know, kind of approach. Let me, you know, or you give them some what's, but then try to coach them along the way to start thinking about the why and the how and thinking about a broader system and not just running through some mechanics to do something. I mean, so I guess I struggle with that as far as, maybe it's kind of a repeat of Chris's question. If you have someone who's coming to you who's very numbers focused, very bottom line, very what do I do, how do I do, what's your coaching tactic like for that person or organization to help reframe and maybe help them appreciate the other things? I don't know.
I haven't developed that yet because let's face it, we're all in the frame of the how and we're all in the frame of measuring monetary value, which there's nothing wrong with that because in our sensitivity to systems, we respect the current system too, because if we dismantle it too fast, then we'll hurt each other. So we want to be respectful of how we engage in this conversation. So I don't have an exact answer, but this is going to take a lot of thought work on our part, right? I mean, on the tactical piece, just from day to day, I do just observe some common sense things that we can do, which is stop running, start breathing, and sort of take a pause, right? Because there's so much wisdom in the value of silence, the value of pausing, the value of really being, right? And not doing. So those are kind of basic wisdom tips, I guess you could call them. But in terms of this larger question of how we reframe economic value, I don't have all the answers, but I do know we can't go in there right now and say, well, throw the money out the door. We will be shown the door if we do that. But you know, it is one of those things that I'll be thinking about for a long, long time, because imagine what we could do if we could build other forms of trust that don't entail, you know, necessarily monetary payment. Now, we do have to help people in that center part of the donut, because you can't thrive as a human being if you're lacking food, water, and shelter, right? So once we get past those basics, then the question becomes, what are other forms of exchange that we can actually utilize? And I have been following some really interesting ways of looking at money by this by Woody Tatch, who's a guy that has founded the Slow Money organization. And he's all about sort of bringing money back to the pace of agriculture and the locality, right? And so they're talking about ways in which you can just, we'll focus more on your local economies, right? Now, I don't really know if that's, I mean, I think there's always gonna be a debate about the scaling between, you know, local and then sort of at scale, the benefits we gain there too. I don't think there's a perfect answer there, but I do know that, you know, we can be asking these questions about what would happen if we exchange currency in a different form of trust rather than dollar. You know, that's what I'm always just curious about, because our monetary system is based on trust right now to some extent, but then we've built up all these other things around it that people rely on. So can some of that community building and connection with people replace some of that fear that we might have that if we don't have money, we can't somehow live fully, right? Mm. I don't know.
I think that might be something like, next time somebody goes to look for a job, they ensure that the company they're working for is giving back to their community as a result of an additional amount as a result of hiring them as maybe not an alternative to a portion of their payment, but like something along those lines where your presence is actually feeling back into the economy. Like, so some companies do this, but I feel like it's always a very small amount, but like, you know, something like a corporate volunteer program or something like that, where people are paid to end up volunteering their hours, but maybe they're just given the time to volunteer the hour. I don't know, but and it varies from company to company. But I think very small instances of this exist in the community at large. But and I think a lot of it is like voluntary only and things along those lines. So they end up being very small. But yeah, I think, you know, awareness might be the first thing, right? Is getting people to understand that this is a thing that they can be doing and broadcasting out a little bit like we are now.
No, that's a really great thought. And I mean, I do volunteer a lot. I pick one nonprofit org at a time. And, you know, I think it's in addition to add on to what you're saying, Chris, spot volunteering is very helpful. At least we're helping something. And Pacific Life is wonderful in terms of community giving. And they allow people to, you know, they actually have a whole website on volunteering. There's all kinds of opportunities. But beyond that, the interesting thing is, I think to really change things, we also have to invest longevity in that volunteering. And so a lot of my current volunteering engagements do have longevity. And when we do that, we're actually so humbled by how little we can do and how much we can do all at the same time, right? Because one of the organizations I work with up here in Orange County is called Hoya Scholars, and it's to help, I'd say, underserved students who don't have support go to college. And so there's a mentoring and tutoring program, and it's tied in with the school district. And so, I've been mentoring this one wonderful young woman now. She's a senior this year ever since she first went into high school and got into the program. And just to watch her explore her interests, which have always been joining the police force, which I'm all for, you know, and I think it's, for me, it's less about, are you going to get into college, and more about, are you finding something you're passionate about, right? And so we've been having like a lot of conversations on how she might actually end up doing this, right? And I think, but what I've noticed in going back to the longevity, what I've noticed in the longevity is you can't be a tourist in society's challenges. And, you know, hearing stories of the type of jobs her parents have to do, how they're gone 7 days a week working minimum wage, right? And then, you know, there was another student I mentored a few years ago before this, whose grades plummeted because they didn't have insurance and she had a toothache, right? So these are the things that, you know, I think teach me more about, or give me a better sense about what's really going on, instead of writing a check or volunteering one time, is getting to know somebody. And then I was also introduced to rap music through this wonderful woman. And, you know, it was like very, very raw. And I asked her about this rap musician, and I was reading the text. I'm like, man, this is a, you know, at that time I was like, this is a 13-year-old reading some really harsh stuff about death and everything. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about suicide and all these other things, but those are all the real eye openers that just make me aware of my own privilege, frankly.
Yeah, definitely. I think I second the, you know, the value you can provide, whether through company or through your own activities, to, like you said, sometimes it's writing a check and sometimes it's, you know, volunteering here and there, but any kind of community involvement in mentoring and being mentored by others are incredibly beneficial. And I think those kind of things seem to be the biggest way to impact someone else's life, as opposed to like a one-time event where, you know, it sounds like the mentorship program you're involved in, or things I've done where you help people on their real problems and you help talk through them, and, you know, and those kind of things are really good. To switch gears a little bit, I'm actually pretty interested. So I think you gave us a really nice, like, big picture view of like quest for value and organizational agility. I guess one follow-up question I have is, what difference would it make day to day if a product owner, because we'll just go with that example, saw themselves as a value owner, what would, how would they think differently? What would they do differently?
I think this is just purely opinion, because we have to admit, how many value owners are there out there? We can barely get product owners to the table. So
yeah,
I mean, one thing would be like a lot more pre-experimentation and customer empathy for sure. And then also, you know, if possible, challenging the economics of funding and how we look at the work within an organization, right? I'm doing chunks of function, or am I trying to tie this chunk of function to something greater that benefits people? And I think that storytelling aspect, I mean, that's one thing that, you know, I think is very important. As a product owner is a good storyteller, because they're a huge connector between the value and the person receiving the value, right? Now, because of the economics books, I'm even afraid to use the word consumer, because apparently that has created a whole distortion. But okay, we'll say the person receiving the value, or the customer, as it were, right? But I mean, I think that kind of energy to drive and pivot, you know, value would be really interesting, because right now, you know, on a macro scale, companies sort of see themselves in the same way many people in companies see their role. I'm a this, I'm a that, right? But what if we could move differently? Now, it is very hard to pivot, because, you know, once you develop a mature functioning company, there's all kinds of parts of the system that are moving, and you can't just pivot on a dime. But what would we do differently with our R&D is my question. I mean, I know there's been kind of like hype lately, but there's been, I'm going to be honest, there's been like sort of innovation hype that's been going on in big sort of management discussions, right? But take it out of the hype world, much like we like to do, you know, and put it into the day-to-day. If we took the hype out of that, could you really carve out a portion for true innovation to do something completely different that takes the existing talents of your company to explore other things, right? And so this whole notion, I know many people are trying labs and other forms of R&D, but I have honestly yet to see Eric Ries's sort of lean startup principles really applied well, meaning the short experiment has a hypothesis with a definite end and determining if you should continue or not, right? So we've tried to bring some of these ideas into an incubation garage that we have at Pacific Wave, where I've literally taken the lean canvas and kind of trimmed it down a little bit and just said, hey, it's an experiment. You can go play with what you want, know your customer, what you're intending to do for them, and then ask yourself, is this experiment worthy of continuing to grow or not, right? So there's kind of a exit criteria, if you will, for this experiment. But I think to really get that engine going is hard, because then people get sucked back into the day-to-day, right? And so it's more like candy now, and it's not really a part of our DNA, where, you know, there are some people that are built for this kind of short-term experimentation and trial and error. And I think, you know, together with the people who are really good at building the core of the company, if we can get these groups to be more than just kind of labs that people go visit, because it's kind of eye candy, that would be really better. Because if you're living it day to day, it doesn't have to be something you're showing to other people. You're just like so involved in it. You know, it reminds me of my dad, who he, before he retired, was a physicist. And man, his lab was so cool. He was always there just doing stuff, right? Measuring things. And he was an applied physicist and specialized in sodium LiDAR lasers, right? And so he's always just tinkering with things. And that passion led to interesting discoveries, you know, and he partnered eventually with atmospheric scientists on measuring sort of particulates in the air and other things. But you need that kind of, there are some people cut out for like that kind of exploration. So like, if there's a way we can get people to explore, how exciting could that be? Because, you know, now we're starting to expand on the possibilities of who we are as humans, right? And with these short experiments, you do have a focus and you do have clarity on kind of this short-term hypothesis and what might become of it.
Yeah, well, it is almost a hierarchy of needs thing too, right? Even for the company. And so I think all too often I do see the system just reinforce kind of the status quo, because there is a particular burn rate and a particular income rate. And, you know, as you said before, the linear economics of it all will typically tends to disincentivize activities like that, unless there's some direct known, even like, you know, possibility of a financial reward, right? You know, as time goes by, I think that, you know, there is this like sustainability aspect of it that that companies will have to look more and more to in the coming future. I think, you know, as far as the lean startup thing type thing goes, you know, the value owner or the product owner does have, you know, does end up owning a narrative around, right? The, you know, they have to explain, they have to tell the story that motivates people emotionally to bring that forward. And I've seen this happen. Sometimes it's not necessarily, you know, I think anybody that is passionate about the innovation and is a good storyteller can swing it into motion. But I definitely think that you're right. The system around it is incentivizing everyone to be skeptical or to not look at that. And if a company is in panic mode, you know, obviously the companies that are really negatively impacted by COVID right now, for example, are in kind of the emergency mode, and this is, you know, they abandon all of these research type things in order to work on them. And then other companies that begin to thrive, it takes them a while to realize, like, hey, we do have enough of a excess capital to start making more risky bets, right? And so I don't know, in product ownership, I do like this idea of like calling it, you know, bets, the language of a bet over a, you know, a feature or something like that. It's like, I bet this will increase the value for our customer. And then, John Cutler talks a lot about that. And I think that, there's a lot to be spoken for there. It's still kind of financially focused, but I do like the idea of shifting the name. I think like it's almost a value advocate rather than a value owner in my mind. It's like,
that's actually even better. You know, I like the value advocate.
Somebody tells a story.
And the other thing that I think we can't forget right now is this circularity. Right. So it's very interesting. We produce a lot of things that are one way, plastic, whatever. And then we don't think about its ultimate circularity. Does it kind of return to the earth and come back? And so I think that's kind of also built in, you know, to the way we think about, I'll say in the US or in Western society, death, right? Yeah. We don't. And so it's like we build a lot of things, but we don't know how to respectfully sunset them. And that's with code, that's with systems, that's with all kinds of products that have only one direction, which is I output it. But the thing is, now you've created something, it's manifested on this planet. How do we get it to churn, right? If we don't churn it into the natural system, we'll create tons of waste and pollution as we have, right? So the circularity, you know, even if you assume that scientifically it's impossible to have a perfect circle, can we improve it? Can we think about it that way? So every product, I guess is what I'm saying, has a lifetime. And if that product owner doesn't have the foresight and vision to determine what that circularity should be, you know, then we're going to stay in the functional realm, you know, so.
And you're right. Like, I think that might be the core of it is, none of the training for product ownership out there I've ever heard has ever spoken of that.
Right? Yes.
And so there's fundamentally no education in this of basically the decomposition of something that you have previously composed, right? It's a very interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think to try to sum it up a little bit, and then maybe we'll hit mobbing for just a little bit, because I feel like we have to before we close. But it seems like I think what you're getting at a lot is to stretch the thinking beyond what's immediate and what's now, what's short-term, the broader system, the long-term view and value. I think just starting to think about those things and start the quest is maybe not the answer, or like it gives you an exact answer of what to do, but it's it gives you at least a journey to start on. So before we close, I would love to keep talking about this forever, but maybe we can hit on it a little bit before we close the show. Is I know you've brought several teams to come, visit mob programming teams, and so what's led you to do that, and what impact do you see from that?
It has been awesome. It really has. It was one of those small changes, and I feel so grateful to have built this relationship and continue to build it with you and your teams. How did this even happen? I mean, I think I can't even remember. Oh, Agile Open. That's how it first happened. And just that wonderful, we have no bug database, was like, bink, poke those ears off. What? And that was the whole thing that led us down the path. And I have to say, the small experiments of mobbing have led to a lot of change of heart with people, especially the leadership, who was highly skeptical of it as being redundant and sort of wasteful. Now, a lot of the light bulbs have gone off. Like, I've even heard one senior leader say to me, wow, the mob team, because he has several, the one that's a mob is rocking it. Yeah. So it's really interesting. I think the thing I would really like to help tighten up is we still don't really understand the patterns. We kind of just all go in and start doing things, which is fine. I'm a naturalist. Just if they're enjoying it and it's benefiting them, that's great. Yeah. But I do want to get back to the conversation about code maintainability and patterns, because I still think we don't have that community ownership yet where I am now, but that's okay. Yeah. I mean, the fact that we're starting to learn together and that it's being recognized now as a way to work, I'm cool with that to start with.
Yeah, what's interesting, I think, about that is, I think that teams that may not have a flow efficiency that or never have experienced it, right? Just mobbing ad hoc like that with no real guardrails or guidance, that can reduce the amount of time it takes for anybody to ask anyone else a question, right? So even if somebody has like a given set of philosophies around code maintainability or not, right? The act of actually working together, where you will talk to each other at any point of the day, is very different than saying, hey, I'm going to send an email to so-and-so because I need the database moved so that I can get it deployed. And all the queuing time goes away and that waste goes away, right? But it doesn't mean necessarily that XP practices are going to manifest themselves in a mob. There's a piece of it of like, advocating for training and things along those lines and getting training in place and different levels of technical coaching. But what I do think happens is people in a mob will end up, if a mob is coached, right, in XP practices or, just because that might be an area of focus, what will happen is somebody will remember one aspect and another person will remember another aspect. And like that, you get that same value of mobbing where you have this collective memory. And a mob will forget less than an individual about that training after that training happened. And it's much more likely that that training will actually survive the onslaught of forgetfulness and other things that humans naturally have, right? So I think that's a really good place to be. And it's kind of, I might've talked to somebody on your team before about basically saying like, don't try and copy other teams you see out there, right? It's an incremental thing. And, to get to where we are today, like we've been doing this for, I think, 8 years now, and every moment, every retrospective, we've done some micro improvement. And so people will start their journey at different times. And I think the XP side of it, people can catch up very quickly on, because it will be like, hey, we're getting a lot of bugs. Well, what can we do about bugs? Well, there's unit testing, and that conversation can happen when you're in a mob, I think much more naturally, because now when there's an error that comes back, it's like, oh, hey, all three of us looked at it, all four of us looked at it and it still came back. And so it's not like, hey, it was just one person's like mistake. It's like, it's been cross-validated by a number of people. The idea went through, right? And so that's when you're like, okay, well, unit testing acceptance may grow or other things along those lines. So,
Well, I'll tell you a really interesting application of it in our organization. And since I didn't get the permission of the people, I won't name their names, but one of the most complex things about testing annuities is that they have really long life cycles, right? So you need to mimic like what's going to happen on the first year anniversary, what's going to happen when people do a withdrawal 5 years from now.
Yeah.
And this one mob on our teams, on my team actually, have found a way to encode business rules. I don't mean code, but encode business rules and actually simulate these conditions. So what's been really exciting is that they've taken some of our most complex annuity writers and now actually have started to automate end-to-end, like what the writer flow would be, you know? And so that's an example of like a lot of these analysts, they actually don't write code, but they encode the right ways in which to trigger business data. So now we have this whole metadata layer of like annuity simulation triggers that was developed. And they just love working together because to see the full system end-to-end, they have to cross many app dev teams. So now we have this kind of like amazing cross-functional team that is using mobbing as a way to encode this knowledge and automate it. So I just wanted to say kudos to you. You know, the little things we start, who knows where they lead.
That's fantastic. That's a great story.
Yeah. And I think I saw it visiting mob programming teams, and we've been talking a lot about expanding your thinking and opening up to new ideas and seeing things from a different perspective. I think visiting another team and how they operate has always really helped me to do that. And it also helps the people who are being visited. They learn a lot from that too, because you get to look into another world and see how they're operating. So, so all of your visits have been fantastic learning for us. And so I guess before we close the show, is there anything else you'd like to plug or share?
No. Thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. I can't wait to see you again in person. And we may just connect with some of your remote mobs as well, just because we're all struggling in this COVID world right now. But, you know, I really miss people. So it's a great opportunity to connect.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we're still doing this remote. So it's very good and fun to have happen. So. All right. Well, so to all of our viewers out there, if you thought that this episode was good for you, I'm really happy about it. If this is an episode that maybe you think you thought of somebody else who maybe could have benefited from this information, please share it with them. I think that that's the best possible thing to do, is to give other people opportunities to ingest things that are useful to them in their context. So, if you know of anybody struggling with these ideas, please share this episode and like and subscribe, and we will see you next time. And thanks, Colleen, for being on the show with us.
You're welcome.